ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here, and welcome to this special series, Getting Lucky Again. This is another one of your favourite episodes from recent times. Geraldine and I were talking about and exploring a conversation about the challenges and threats that we are facing as a nation. It became very real a few days after this episode was first broadcast back in December last year, when Australia's worst ever terrorist attack unfolded. Two gunmen randomly targeted people celebrating Hanukkah at Bondi Beach. They killed 15 people, including one child. It was a terrible time of shock and grief and anger. So what can we do as a society to protect ourselves?
Australia has been known for punching well above its weight in the past. But in the world that's evolving, not on old rules, the big question is, can we continue to do so?
So we really wanted to give you something fresh to think about. In this series, we're asking a series of experts, big thinkers, for their ideas, not just about the challenges we face, though we want them to look at those squarely in the eye, but consider the opportunities that could take Australia forward in this context.
And we plan to do things a little bit differently. We're handing over to our guests to present us with their ideas first before we chime in our usual way to put them to the test.
Lydia Khalil, who's Program Director of the Transnational Challenges Program, what a mouthful, at the Lowy Institute. Lydia is immersed in the murky world of transnational threats, and she'll explain exactly what that means as well. She's been looking at how they're making their way here to Australia, so we're keen to hear what she has to say on that and maybe whether there is an opportunity that might present itself there. Welcome to Global Roaming, Lydia. Would you like to take it away?
Well, Hamish, Geraldine, it's great to be with you and all your listeners. And today I want to talk to you about what I think is one of the most complex challenges facing Australia, and that's the rise of the grey zone. Now, if you don't work in national security, diplomacy, or military affairs, you might not have heard of the term grey zone, but you've definitely come across some examples without knowing that it has a name. So we know that shadowy cyber networks exist. Some of them are cyber criminals out to make a buck, but others are secretly operating on behalf of another country to disrupt critical infrastructure or to undermine our ability to respond at a time of strategic advantage. Then there was the time in 2020 when China instituted sanctions and trade blockages on a number of our exports when Australia dared to call for an independent international inquiry into the origins of the COVID-19 virus. You've also likely heard about Russian-sponsored disinformation campaigns, where they use online bots or even pay accounts to spread pro-Russian propaganda and fake news, to sway people's sentiments on political and social issues, to sow discord, even to try to influence the outcomes of elections. And most recently, the Australian government expelled the Iranian ambassador and accused Iran of using criminal groups to sponsor and conduct two attacks against Jewish targets. Now, all of these examples are countries operating in the gray zone, deploying coercive tactics and operations to strong-arm other states' behavior. These type of operations are more intimidating than diplomacy, but they fall below that threshold of armed conflict. Just like a colleague might sabotage a work project that you're leading to get one up on you on a promotion, gray zone activities by nation states are designed to undermine. It's passive aggressiveness on a state level, indirect and manipulative methods to achieve intended purposes while avoiding direct confrontation. And so this is the gray zone, this shadowy space between war and peace. This type of behavior is not new. In fact, it's ancient. It's an ancient type of statecraft practiced and promoted by strategists throughout history. You've had Sun Tzu, who always aimed to subdue the enemy without fighting, or the Indian Arthashastra texts that discuss how the incitement of coups and rebellions and targeted assassinations can be used to achieve larger strategic aims. So it's not new, but it's a growing challenge that's charged by digital technology and is now becoming the main means of great power competition. We've had Andrew Scherer, Australia's outgoing head of national intelligence, say during Senate estimates that the guardrails that have for decades separated competition from confrontation and conflict are weakening. The distinctions now between power, war, and crime dissolve, and this is where the gray zone lives and thrives. Gray zone behavior is also growing because it gives states a clear comparative advantage during a time when the rules-based order is breaking down. For one thing, there's the attribution issue. Gray zone tactics disguise actors, intentions, even desired outcomes, which make combating adversarial actors that use them all the more difficult. Put more simply, sometimes you can't be sure who you're dealing with, or if you do, you don't know why. Is this cyber intrusion the work of a state actor or a criminal group? How do we judge when economic pressure is genuine trade policy or coercion? Did that foreign company acquire critical infrastructure for commercial reasons or strategic positioning? So ambiguity is the name of the game. It deliberately keeps you guessing to thwart prevention and response. Second, in international relations, whether it's diplomacy or warfare, there are rules and norms that govern how states are expected to behave and provide parameters for how other countries can respond. Gray zone tactics deliberately skirt all of those rules. Because gray zone falls between that space of war and peace, it's unclear which international laws and norms apply, and that makes it very hard to respond. Non-response encourages this behavior. Responding directly without warning could be counterproductive. A direct military action would be disproportionate, or worse, trigger an escalation. And democracies like Australia are particularly vulnerable to all this. Not only is targeting our democratic political system and its elections a form of gray zone behavior, but our openness, our commitment to the rule of law, our interconnected economy, all strengths under normal circumstances, become attack surfaces that competitor states can exploit in gray zone competition. And gray zone tactics not only target governments, but entire societies. So you not only have to up your diplomatic, intelligence, and defense game, you have to embark upon a multi-pronged effort of societal resilience. And I want to drill down on a few of the gray zone tactics that get to the heart of undermining our democratic system and values. First are disinformation campaigns. States engage in disinformation campaigns to create a polluted information environment to confuse and manipulate people. Disinformation campaigns breed distrust in democratic institutions. They contribute to polarization. Disinformation around election interference and fraud have sowed doubt about the integrity of elections. Russia and China have engaged in this information manipulation widely. Their campaigns are both targeted and broad. Now, not all disinformation campaigns are the product of foreign manipulation. Much of it is homegrown, but states will often take advantage and leverage those as well. The second tactic is the use of sabotage operations to exacerbate social tensions. Here, Iran's actions in Australia post-October 7th is the most clear and recent illustration. Iran has been notorious for sabotage operations against its adversaries, and until recently, Australia has been largely spared. But when it orchestrated at least two attacks that we know of against Jewish target, it aimed to stoke tensions already present in the community about the war in Gaza and Australia's response. These types of societal fractures about overseas conflicts and divisive issues makes us vulnerable to interference and coercion. And third is the harassment, threat, or even killing of dissidents. A recent parliamentary inquiry into foreign interference laid out example after example. China has targeted critics of the CCP in Australia. Russia has targeted Ukrainians and Russian dissidents for intimidation. Agents working on behalf of Iran have targeted the diaspora community who call for more human rights in Iran. Even India has also been accused of orchestrating assassination plots against separatist leaders based in Canada and America. And lastly is direct election interference, actions that either disrupt or influence the election process in another country. This can be done through disinformation, or it can be hacking into a political party's communication system, like what Russia did in the United States during the 2016 elections, or other things to undermine the integrity of elections, or even directly through cyber attacks against election infrastructure, like was attempted in Estonia by the Russians. These gray zone tactics intersect with our own domestic challenges. For these types of tactics to work, there has to be something already there to exploit. Coercive and manipulative tactics work best when they expand existing tensions and widen existing fissures in our society. We're in an era of global democratic decline, and that decline makes democracies even more vulnerable to coercion from adversaries and challengers. We went from a situation after the Cold War where more and more countries were turning from communism and autocracy to democracy. Now in the 21st century, democratic backsliding is the prevailing trend. And no matter how you measure it, all the organizations that track democracy are showing global democratic declines. And we're also experiencing strains on our social cohesion. We talked about October 7th and how it was an opportunity for sabotage, but it also created deep divisions among faith communities, and it led to an increase in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, disruptive demonstrations, violent attacks, and threats against elected representatives. The Scanlon Social Cohesion Report also shows that young people who have a sense of belonging in Australia has declined significantly from a decade ago, and we are more socially disconnected than ever. We've had the growth of anti-government movements and sentiments post-COVID as well, where you had conspiracists and sovereign citizens who fundamentally don't believe in the legitimacy of the states. There are threats to our largely successful multicultural model from neo-Nazi groups who are trying to go mainstream and are exploiting broad anxieties about immigration and the economy. We've had a steady clip of large anti-immigration protests across Australia where neo-Nazis and white nationalists are actively participating and organizing, some of whom even have links to foreign actors and movements. Australia's been called the lucky country. But to meet this global moment, one that's risky, less stable, where the rules-based order is breaking down, we've got to shift our understanding of luck. It's been said that luck is when preparation meets opportunity. At a time when the world is increasingly unsafe and unpredictable, where Australia sits at the crossroads of great power competition in the Indo-Pacific and democracy is under strain, we've got to become more prepared and more coordinated. Yes, we're lucky in that our democracy is still relatively robust, but we have to continue and strengthen our efforts to safeguard it and to make it even more resilient. Our democracy simply cannot be taken for granted. We have to invest in resilience, not just government resilience, but societal resilience. This means working with Australian businesses and universities, working with diaspora communities, addressing disinformation, not just through media literacy, which is important, but by disrupting the networks and holding platforms to account. We have to improve our social safety net and address inequality, isolation, and division so that everyone has a shared sense of belonging. We also have to work with our regional allies on gray zone and foreign interference issues. This is particularly important because the U.S. is no longer interested in remaining the global leader that upholds democratic values and international rules and norms. As imperfect and flawed and even sometimes dangerous that effort was by the United States over the years, the lack of the U.S. interest in upholding these norms is a loss to Australia. We have no choice but to take a lead on coordination and cooperation in our region. And we also need to be more willing to call out gray zone behavior and develop and clearly communicate our responses. If you do this, we will do that. Communicating clearly and effectively, essentially creating a new rule set around gray zone competition. To remain the lucky country in the 21st century, Australia needs to reframe its understanding of what luck means. No longer can luck mean being the happy recipient of good fortune. The lucky country needs to become the prepared country. And as luck would have it, Australia still has some time to prepare to meet this challenge, but not too much.
Lydia, thank you so much. I've got so many questions. Before we jump into it, though, I just want to remind listeners, you're listening to ABC Radio National's Global Roaming. It's Hamish here.
And Geraldine Doogue as well.
With us is the Lowy Institute's Lydia Khalil. I wanted to pick up on something you said right at the end of your wonderful talk, Lydia, and that is about preparedness and rethinking what luck looks like. Are there features of Australia that we can still rely on? Like, obviously, geographic distance, physical distance has been something that's been valuable to us. Our diaspora communities you've referenced as well. How might these features be used to tackle this moment?
It's a great question. And you're right that our geography does insulate us to a certain extent, but less and less so. We all know that in globalization with digitization, the physical geography is less and less impactful. So we have to reframe our understanding of that. We can't rely on our sense of the tyranny of distance anymore as a protective factor. But you're right that we have so many strengths that we can definitely draw on for resilience. Our multicultural, pluralistic society is a huge strength. I've outlined how some of it can be targeted, but it's also a huge source of strength. And yes, we have strains and tensions, but overall that model has worked relatively well. And I think we need to talk that up a bit. We have to constantly reinforce how that is a strength of our society, because it has, objectively it has. We've also got relative prosperity. So we have to take a look at how we can just make that a bit more equitable. We've had inequality rising globally, and particularly among Western democracies. And luckily, because we do have some sort of safety net that's absent in, say, the United States, for example, what we can do is we can look to reinforce and strengthen that even more.
And I mean, are we talking about rogue actors here who are perpetrating, you know, changing the rules, as you, or trying to change our rules, more to the point, or, you know, state-sponsored actors? Like, who is exactly doing this kind of thing? It's very rarely named or called out. Now, that's allegedly part of a whole new strategy that, you know, you do things in a way that clearly conveys it without naming it. But how would you answer that?
Well, you're exactly right, Geraldine, that all of this is part of that broader strategy. Very difficult to attribute who the actor is, what their intentions are, why they're doing it, and that makes it really difficult to respond. Sometimes it seems like we have an obvious answer. Oh, this is an extremist group that's conducting a particular attack or driving a piece of disinformation campaign. But we might come to find out that they have a little bit of foreign help behind those actions. It's a combination of both international and national, that transnational dimension of this challenge. So you're absolutely right. It is part of a broader strategy. I think what we need to do is take a little bit of a risk and be a little bit more blunter and bolder about calling it out. Not just Australia. We don't want to completely go out on a limb on our own. But as I mentioned, I think it's important to work with regional actors as well and allies who are also the subject of these type of actions. And you're right to point out as well that a lot of this activity is being conducted by what we call revisionist states. So states that are trying to change the status quo. Russia is a revisionist state. It's trying to undermine the rules-based order in order to do things like undermine sovereignty and conduct an illegal invasion of another country so they can regain territory. That's a massive violation.
That is very blunt, but I mean, in some of these other areas, there's that clear, plausible deniability, that phrase that basically a lot of us sit and watch and think, really? Would they bother? You know, what's in it for them? It's so obvious this is a sort of a sidebar, not the main game, if you know what I mean. Now, are you sort of counselling people like me to think again, to really step up and be a bit more anxious?
Because I think the danger in part is that you can fold so many different things into this broad concept of grey zone, and does it ultimately then mean nothing? You know, the sort of trust or the liar's dividend they talk about, right? Where you don't have to see that much doubt to then make the broader population doubt everything.
Well, quite. And particularly once you get organised crime involved. I mean, I think there's lots of efforts to stay rational and reasonable among good people in Australia that I think you're telling us we got to think again. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not quite, but you do point to an important point that when we talk about these things or when we try to highlight the risks involved or to highlight these behaviours, we have to be careful to do it in a way that doesn't turn us all into a bunch of anxious paranoids, right? We have to have some sort of trust in the world, in our governments, in society. And what I'm saying is that we do need to think about these in broad terms. So here I see that there's a big role for government to play in terms of communicating, listen, we're living in a very risky world. Sometimes states are doing things where they're operating outside of the bounds. We're doing our best to address these challenges. We're addressing them in various levels, sometimes in direct government relations, you know, in foreign relations, sometimes through intelligence and behind the scenes. But also, as a society, you need to be aware that this is the new environment that you're in. And in order to help us address it, don't be an anxious paranoid. Actually, go out and have more connection, more resilience, more community, more awareness. And in that sense, we can build up that level of broader societal resilience that I was advocating for.
Lydia, I wonder if it's actually worth introducing an example that I suspect many listeners might have stumbled across over the past year. For a period in the back half of the year, I was being contacted constantly on my morning radio show with listeners saying, why aren't you talking about these new road rules that I'm reading about? And it's been flooding social media for Australians for a good 6 months. Stories about over 65s being given a curfew for driving on the road. People being told that you can no longer have a sip of water while you're driving a car. People being told that you have to keep your headlights on 24 hours a day. And this is all totally fake news. But I ran into the Transport Minister, the Federal Transport Minister, Catherine King, in Canberra, and she started talking to me about it. But what was interesting to me was that Catherine King speculated that it probably was a disinformation campaign. They don't know who it was. This was something they were investigating further. So could you help listeners, Lydia, understand where that might come from? Why might that happen? What exactly is the objective?
Oh, that's a fascinating example. I missed that one. I must not be online enough
to have seen that one.
But no, that is fascinating. And it shows you how tricky it can be, right? Because it's a fairly innocuous type of information about road rules, right? So we're not talking about an election or a referendum or, a big political action or a divisive social issue. These are very everyday things. But what it does is it muddies the water. It throws dirt in the clarity. And I think that's the point of disinformation campaigns, that we have to try to understand them in that way. Oftentimes, we look at them as a form of manipulation, and I've talked in the past about how they are manipulative tactics. So they're meant to sway your opinion or your position in a particular way. But oftentimes, what their broader aim is just to muddy the water, where you just can't trust what the information is, where it comes from, whether it's true or not. And what that breeds is this kind of broader sense of distrust and apathy and people just throwing their hands up and being like, who knows what's true anymore?
So in terms of our response to this, Lydia, Gideon Rackman wrote recently that the best response to Russian hybrid warfare may be a Western version of grey zone tactics. And specifically, he suggests using offensive cyber capabilities. I'd take the opportunity just to point listeners back to our new Frontlines miniseries, our interview with Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, the interviews we did with the NATO Hybrid Threat Center in Finland. Really fascinating stuff. A lot of detail there about what Russia's doing in terms of weaponized migration and various other tactics. It's pretty full scale in that part of the world. But what do you think about that idea, fighting back with grey zone tactics for a country like Australia in our region?
I mean, well, first of all, let's not pretend that some democracies don't do covert operations. They do. I mean, we know that the United States has done it throughout its history and its time as a global leader. So those things do happen. But I get a little uncomfortable around saying, well, let's just respond like for like. Because what that does is just erode, again, the system even further. It erodes those rules and those norms even further. And then you just get to this point where it's a free-for-all, right? Might makes right. That's exactly what we're trying to avoid. And so I think maybe the answer lies in, again, working with regional partners and allies to develop almost like an alternative type of rule set. One of the issues, one of the reasons what makes gray zone behavior so effective is because there is this confusion around what the response will be. And so if we can bring some clarity around what the response will be, then that might help deter some of those things. It's an ongoing challenge that we have to deal with. But for example, should we have some sort of clarity and coordination around the attribution of cyber attacks? Should we have some clarity and coordination around what exactly constitutes economic coercion? Can we work with our regional partners and allies to develop those sets of standards and norms, almost reworking that rules-based order that has eroded?
Yes. For instance, Lydia, we can't match arson with other countries. Like, you know, there's some fascinating work about the amount of drones that Russia has been sending all over Europe, outside hospitals, outside broadcast authorities, outside airports. It hasn't actually had much coverage in Australia. And then they just pull back and Putin smiles more or less and sort of says, what are you talking about? With one of those enigmatic smiles of his. So can we play anything like those games in our region?
Well, we've seen, you know, particularly with Ukraine, how warfare has shifted. And you bring about the example of the use of drones. I mean, that is like a huge experiment right now in terms of demonstrating how relatively low-cost types of military provisions, like drones, can have massive effects. And so one of the lessons I think that we can take, and we are taking, is the use of how drone warfare, for example, has transformed warfighting. How can we then incorporate that in our defense strategies, in our defensive posture, and in when we have to respond operationally as well?
All right. Well, look, you've just given us plenty to think about, and it's not simple. That's the lovely thing. We'll chew over it.
So, Lydia, we always love getting recommendations on global roaming, and we're wondering if you'd perhaps offer something for our listeners to either read, watch, or listen to.
I'm a big fan of alternative histories, and given the state of the world today, who wouldn't want to see another timeline and see how that might look? So there's been two television recommendations that I've got that do focus on this alternative history framing. Both are a few years old now, but I think they're still worth watching. One of them is Man in the High Castle, which is a TV adaptation of this science fiction novel by Philip K. Dick. And it's got one of my favorite actors in there, Rufus Sewell, who I always loved since he played Will Ladislaw in the adaptation of Middlemarch.
Well, I agree completely.
Yeah, he's terrific. And the book and the TV series, so they depict this alternative history where Axis powers actually win World War II. And it shows an America divided into Japanese and German occupied zones and a neutral zone, and it shows just a completely different world order. And it shows the efforts of anti-fascists that are fighting occupation in America. And it's a great fictionalization and I think a warning about fascism, which I found fascinating, both the book and the TV series. The other alternative history series, which I've been loving, is For All Mankind. So it's four seasons in and it's terrific. It's about the space race. But this time, instead of Americans first landing on the moon, the Russians did it first. And it explores all the consequences to that in terms of not only how the space program develops or how the Cold War plays out, but its impacts on women's rights and equality and the broader trajectory of the Cold War. And it's got great characters, great running. And I really love especially how the show depicts the male characters in this and how the adjustment to a more equitable kind of framing or more equitable space program is actually quite seamless. So I thought it was a little bit off the stereotype there, and I really like that.
Oh, they're great suggestions, neither of which I was alert to. Look, thank you, Lydia, very much indeed. As you say, it's not been an easy outline of threats and opportunities, but we're very grateful.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always great to talk to you.
That's the Lowy Institute's Lydia Khalil there. If you found this conversation interesting or thought-provoking, I'd really recommend that you go back and look for another mini-series that we put together, The Matter of Facts. We ran it in tandem with the television series, but a number of podcasts with the likes of Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, also an American academic who thinks that the best thing, the most powerful thing you can do in this time of mis and disinformation is to just pick up a physical book and read it. There's a lot there for you to pick through if you're interested in these issues. Also, a look at the impacts of AI on the information systems that we all live with here in Australia today. In this series of favourite agenda-setting episodes, our next is another wake-up call, this time on the economy. Michael Stutchbury is the former editor-in-chief of the Australian Financial Review. He's the executive director of the Centre for Independent Studies. And we're going to have a pretty rough and tumble conversation about spending and savings. I'm Hamish McDonald. The email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.